Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Job losses mount, a heavy stimulus bill passes the first hurdle, and President Obama goes to Capitol Hill to convince skeptical Republicans that the plan just might work. But with billions in bailout money already sent to banks, there are questions over where the stimulus money will go. Despite record losses last year, we learned this week that Wall Street banks doled out $18 billion in Christmas bonuses, a number that shocked the president.
That is the height of irresponsibility. It is shameful.
Republicans might agree with that sentiment, but not with the president's economic recovery plan. They say it's fiscal irresponsibility taken to the extreme. Here's Congressman Mike Kaufman of Colorado.
We cannot borrow and spend our way back to prosperity.
And in Illinois, Governor Rod Blagojevich is out of a job after the state Senate impeached him yesterday.
And there are tens of thousands of people across America, just like me, who are losing their jobs or lost their jobs. So I'm not looking for any pity, and I don't need anybody to sympathize or feel bad for me, because I'll be just fine.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind these headlines and more. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Will the stimulus package stimulate this anemic economy? And joining us from Washington is Charles Babington. He covers the White House and politics for the Associated Press. Charles, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
Also with us from New York is Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's an associate editor, and blogger for The Atlantic and the author of the memoir The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. Ta-Nehisi, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Guy. Charles and Ta-Nehisi.
Gentlemen, before we delve into it, I wanted to play a brief clip from President Obama earlier this week. He was meeting with 13 CEOs on Wednesday to discuss the economy, and he said that his stimulus plan would have an immediate impact on this economy. Let's take a listen.
Most of the money that we're investing as part of this plan will get out the door immediately and go directly to job creation, generating or saving 3 to 4 million new jobs. And the vast majority of these jobs will be created in the private sector because, as these CEOs well know, business, not government, is the engine of growth in this country.
Charles Babington, I want to begin with you. This stimulus package is one of the biggest, the single biggest pieces of legislation in dollar terms ever passed. Is there genuine optimism on Capitol Hill that this plan will work, or does it seem like a crapshoot?
There is optimism among some Democrats in particular, at least they profess it to be, but I think there's more of the second point that you made, Guy, and that is no one really seems sure, and you have some pretty smart economists who are just all over the map on this thing, that it's the best thing to do, it's the right idea, it's a terrible idea, and members of Congress are, for the most part, are not economists. They have to look for outside help on this, and that's one dilemma, is that the outside help is so all over the place. But I think more than anything else, they feel that the public is so concerned and so frightened by what's going on that something has to be done. That's the majority feeling in Congress. Let's take some action, hope it's the best, but we just can't sit on our hands.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about more than $800 billion by the time it gets out of the Senate. That could top $900 billion. We should make it clear that part of this is spending, but part of this is also made up of tax cuts. Can you break it down for us, Charles?
Yeah, it's about a fourth to a third tax cuts. The Republicans would like that to be a higher number. At one point, it was like 40%. It's come down from that some. The biggest criticism you hear from the Republicans, and as you noted, not a single one of them voted for this in the House, is that it's just got too much spending in it that's not clearly stimulative, that is for all kinds of things that look like, at best, they're down the road investments in alternative fuels, fighting avian flu, $1 billion for the Census Bureau, that sort of thing. And they feel that the Democrats and President Obama are using this as a vehicle to load it up with kind of the liberal agenda, the items that they would like to get done anyway that would be much more problematic on a case-by-case basis. But they feel like they're sort of opening up the suitcase and packing all this other stuff into it.
Yeah, and earlier this week, Republican Minority Leader John Boehner, who in some ways is probably the leader of the Republican Party nowadays, had this to say about President Obama's stimulus plan.
And I think that the proposal that we have that puts more money back in the hands of American families and small businesses, that helps homeowners and people who want to buy a home, and that takes away the tax liability for those who are unemployed and getting unemployment insurance, that this bill, in fact, will be better for the American people, that better meets the goal that the president himself has outlined.
Jack Beatty, we just heard from John Boehner, the Republican minority leader in the House of Representatives. Does he have a point? Is President Obama's stimulus plan enough, or is it simply another example of wasteful spending?
It's hard to argue it's wasteful spending. The Republicans have said, we can't borrow and spend our way to prosperity, and yet that's precisely what you have to do in a recession. You have to borrow and spend your way to prosperity. The shortfall in the private and the economy over the next 2 years is estimated at $2 trillion of lost economic activity. This is an $825 billion stimulus package. Even with a multiplier, that doesn't get to $2 trillion. Now, this week, the Society of American Engineers released a report on the state of America's infrastructure, and they say it would take about $2 trillion to bring our infrastructure up to code. And I suspect that as the recession deepens and it looks like it's getting momentum, it looks like we have not only inflationary depression in recessionary psychology, we have a recessionary culture growing. I think the Democrats are going to have to come back and stimulate more and go more in the direction of infrastructure spending, because there are two cycles here. One is the economic cycle, and the other is the political cycle for the 2010 elections, and the Democrats don't want to go into that election with the economy the way it is today.
And we should note, Jack, that just a few hours ago, the quarterly GDP numbers came out, and the U.S. economy shrank by 3.8% in the last quarter, which is, of course, significant. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I want to ask you about the selling of this plan. The commander-in-chief this week became the lobbyist-in-chief, in a sense, when he made the rounds on Capitol Hill to woo reluctant Republicans. He even had some of them over to the White House for cocktails, something that the teetotaling President Bush certainly didn't do over the past 8 years. What do you make of this charm offensive, and how long can it last?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it. The first is that he got zero support, ultimately, when the votes were counted. So from that perspective, I think a lot of people would say it was a failure. I think there's a long-term way of looking at it, though. I think there's the perspective of Obama continually, President Obama, got to get used to saying that now, President Obama presenting himself as a person that's willing to talk, willing to compromise, willing to see other sides, willing to listen to opposition, and sort of painting his opponents as obstructionists, as people who won't work with him. Of course, the other side of that also is, should the stimulus package ultimately fail, it'll be his. I would argue that it was going to be his anyway. The war had Democratic support, but ultimately it was Bush's war when it all came down to it. So I think over the long term, I think always looking like a person who's willing to talk to the opposition, a person that's willing to possibly compromise, is probably a good tactic.
Mm-hmm. One area of common ground, of course, Jack Beatty, between the president and Republicans on Capitol Hill are these Wall Street bonuses. Almost $20 billion in Wall Street bonuses doled out last year. News that certainly did not sit well with politicians on both sides of the aisle. What do you make of this news, Jack?
Well, I think that I applaud the president for his comment. This is shameful. His comment was reminiscent of John F. Kennedy's in 1962 when the steel industry boosted prices beyond inflation. And his private comment, which was picked up in the press, was big businessmen are SOBs. We haven't quite got that from the president, but we did hear about this irresponsibility. You know, these really gargoyles of greed on Wall Street, the poster boy now being John Thain.
Bank of America CEO.
Yeah, you know, it isn't just that they have fattened their own product pockets while the economy has gone down. Their actions have precipitated the crash in the economy. Ordinary people all over the country are hurting because of the irresponsibility and misjudgments of these men. And just this week, the New York Times reported a candid comment from a banker, John C. Hope III, what a name, talking at the Ritz-Carlton in Palm Beach to fellow bankers. And he said, you know, the government wants them to make more loans. And he said, quote, make more loans? We're not going to change our business model or our credit policies to accommodate the needs of the public sector. Mm. In other words, we'll take public money to prop us up, but public be damned in letting out loans.
All right. And Charles Babington, it puts the president in a tough position. He's trying to sell the stimulus plan, and it seems as if some of the bailout money by banks may have been used for bonuses.
And the bailout money is very unpopular with the public, and it's one of the things that Republicans in Congress are really pointing to. They talk about bailout fatigue. And they're kind of connecting, even though it's not a total connection, of course, but the stimulus package to the bailout type of spending, and some of them are taking cover or at least citing that when they express their opposition. I think Jack has hit a really good point, and you know, with the severe problems on Wall Street and corporate America, you're starting to see a greater intersection between
Wall Street. Hold that point for one moment, Charles. We'll be right back. I'm Guy Raz, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. My guests today are Ta-Nehisi Coates of The Atlantic, Charles Babington from the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Charles Babington, I broke you off just before the break. I wanted to ask you about this stimulus plan writ large. It essentially doubles the education budget. About 10% of the money is for infrastructure projects, roads and bridges. But there's a lot of money for entitlement programs. How, in your view, would that kind of spending stimulate the economy? If it will at all.
Yeah. To the degree that money in one form or another goes to lower income people, they are the most likely ones to spend that money quickly because they tend to live from paycheck to paycheck. And that's what stimulating the economy is about. So in other words, if you put money into the hands of more upper income people, they're more likely to perhaps save it or just to pay down their credit card, that sort of thing. So you mentioned entitlement. There is, for example, an element in this that's strongly opposed by most Republicans that would increase the amount of money that goes to people who work and make income but don't make enough money to owe federal taxes. There's actually millions of people in that category, and right now they get money through the earned income tax credit. A lot of people don't even realize that, but this through a different mechanism, this stimulus plan would do the same type of thing. So to that degree, I think most economists would say that would have a stimulative effect. But as you point out, there's just all kinds of other things in there that would take much longer to pump money into the economy. Mm-hmm. And that's where the critics say that gets away from the goal of the stimulus.
And Ta-Nehisi Coates, I'm curious from your vantage point, where are the Republicans on this? It seems as if they're kind of trapped. On the one hand, coming out with platitudes and praise for the president and for his behavior and his respect toward them. On the other hand, not really offering much of an alternative to his plan. They're in a pretty tight spot.
Yeah, it's a pretty difficult position to see. And we've seen this not just on the stimulus plan, but on the whole thing with Rush Limbaugh this week and, you know, people excuse me, having to apologize for being on his show and then not apologize, et cetera. I think they're in a position where you don't have a leader. And it's always like this when you're, you know, suddenly put into a position where you're the opposition party. So there's this whole debate. How much do you oppose Obama? How much do you try to be a part of the solution? There's a concern about being the party of no or being the party of actual solutions. I think there are just so many different lines of tension pulling at them in terms of which way to go. How do you position yourself best for the 2010 elections? At the same time, how do you not necessarily look like an obstacle towards progress for America at large?
Charles Babington, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and Jack Beatty, we have callers lined up to ask you all questions. And our first caller is Brian. He's in Verona, Virginia. Brian, welcome to the program.
I have a bad thought, and I'd like the panel to comment on this. It occurs to me that the economic cave-in is a symptom and not actually the problem. In my opinion, the problem is that in the 80s and the 90s, we moved American jobs offshore, and that all of this stimulus stuff isn't going to help until we bring the jobs back from China and Mexico and other foreign countries.
Brian, do you mind just telling us, what do you do for a living?
I'm a semi-truck driver. Previous lives, I was a nuclear engineer, an electronics design engineer, and I couldn't even buy a job.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of Brian's point here?
Well, there's no doubt that that many American manufacturing jobs, especially, have been offshored in recent years. This bill, there are some Buy American provisions in there. I think there's something there about buying uniforms for federal officials from American plants. I think there's in the $3 billion or so for rapid transit spending, there is a provision to buy American cars. So there are some features in this that will protect that essentially, in other words, people won't just be buying goods that are from China. They'll be buying goods, or at least government will, from the United States. But it's hard to see the trade issue, which I join with Brian in thinking is a serious problem for ordinary Americans, especially in manufacturing. It's hard to connect that with what is primarily here a financial crisis in ideology.
Mm-hmm. Brian, thanks so much for the call. And we should note that, as we noted earlier, a significant portion of the stimulus package includes large tax cuts, something that that even many Democrats were uncomfortable with. Of course, the vote passed basically largely along party lines. Let's hear from Kenny now. He's in White River Junction, Vermont, I believe. Kenny, can you hear us? Are you there?
I can. Hi, Guy.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a couple points. One is, I don't believe there's nearly enough tax cuts in the stimulus package. I can't think of a faster way to put money in the hands of all taxpaying Americans other than cutting payroll taxes and make it retroactive to January 1st. I mean, that's money that people will see in their paychecks this week and next week. And it's stimulative, and it encompasses all economic groups that actually do pay taxes. This idea of earned income tax credits back to people that don't pay taxes to begin with, that's a redistribution of wealth in disguise. I think this stimulus package should be more than 50% tax cuts, about 25% in infrastructure improvement, and the only other thing that I can see that really needs to be done is the federal government needs to put money into the states for Medicaid reimbursements. And the only other point I'd like to make, this notion that the this idea that the Democrats threw into this infrastructure part of this program to only buy American materials is absolutely insane. This is a world economic problem. We've created it, by all accounts, and to lock the rest of the world out from being able to sell us materials for this, in many cases, at a cheaper price. I mean, it puts everybody on a level playing field. You know, if you even the tariffs, put everybody on a level playing field, allow everybody to bid on these materials from anywhere, and the lowest bidder wins. That's mm-hmm. the way it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. And You can't just shut out, you know, Chinese steel or Turkish steel, you know, or you know, any of these other things. You got to allow them to play too. I mean, it's to go into a protectionist mode at this point would be insane.
Kenny, hold that thought for a moment. Let's break it down for a moment. Charles Babington, Kenny's argument. Not enough tax cuts in the stimulus plan, and President Obama actually under considerable pressure from members of his own party not to include as many tax cuts as he did.
That's right, Guy, that, you know, there's this general divide between the Republicans would like to see more tax cuts, less spending. A number of Democrats, especially the more liberal ones, feel that there's been an awful lot of tax cuts, especially for upper-income Americans during the Bush administration. You know, one point we should make to Kenny's remarks is that every worker, no matter how little he or she makes, does pay payroll taxes, and that's that FICA line that you see on your pay stub, and it goes for Social Security and Medicare. And so when there are a number of workers who do not pay income taxes, but everyone pays payroll taxes. And as he correctly noted, the tax, one of the main tax cuts in this would be effectively to try to help offset some of those payroll taxes. So that would have put money, you're right, directly into paychecks right away. Not a huge amount of money, but some, and it would go to everyone. But obviously, there's a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill who agree with him. There should be more taxes further up the line, more tax cuts, rather.
Jack?
Yeah, and you know, we've been this way before, to Kenny's point. We did have that tax, that general rebate last year. It didn't work. Much of it was saved. And studies show that for every dollar in food stamps, for example, you get $1.73 in economic activity. For every dollar in infrastructure, you get about $1.40. For every dollar in tax cuts, only $1.03. So just from the point of view of efficacy, it strikes me that money for poorer Americans via food stamps, unemployment, or temporarily poorer Americans, unemployment compensation and the like, that's the most stimulative. The second would be infrastructure, and the third in efficacy would be tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. And of course, more and more bad news this week, lots of job cuts, about 500,000 job losses per month now. The economy continuing to shrink. The Postal Service now considering cutting back on a day of mail delivery. This week, Postmaster General John Potter was actually on Capitol Hill testifying in front of the Senate when he essentially said, you know, this is something that they may have to consider.
The ability to suspend the delivery on the lightest delivery days will save dollars in both our delivery and processing and distribution networks.
Jack Beatty, a day less of mail delivery, is it a big deal or is it just another sign of the times?
I think it's another sign of the times and of how this recession is really changing behavior of all systems, of all organizations. And the great danger, of course, is that this then generates its own momentum of fear, and more and more Americans do the right thing for themselves, which is to save money, but that's the wrong thing for the economy, which is precisely the reason why the government has to, in a massive way, spend and borrow, because everybody's instincts now are to protect themselves. That's just the wrong thing to do for the economy.
Mark is on the line from New Britain, Connecticut. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Guy. I just think President Obama needs to face an unpleasant political fact, and that is that the Republican leadership does not want him to succeed, does not like him, and does not, frankly, care who gets hurt in the process. I mean, listen to what Jack was just saying about where stimulus really comes from, right? The Republicans push for tax cuts in this package, push for tax cuts. When they get them, now all of a sudden they won't vote for the bill because it hasn't got enough enough infrastructure spending.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's no way that President Obama is going to bring the Republicans over to his side, and I think it's time for him to just start playing Chicago politics and put forward the plans that he got elected to be put forward.
Mark, thanks so much. Ta-Nehisi Coates, what do you make of Mark's point? Should President Obama start playing Chicago-style politics, something we've heard about from former Governor Blagojevich, or should he continue this charm offensive that he's been on?
Yeah, see, I understand that from a short-term political perspective. Like, if your only goal is to get more Republicans to sign on, then, you know, maybe not. But if your goal is to maybe get more Republicans to sign on and also to, again, as I originally said, to portray yourself as somebody who's willing to listen to opposition, to someone who's not going to just ram through legislation, to someone who will listen to your friends as well as your quote-unquote enemies, if you want to put it that way. I guess I prefer opposition. I think it's extremely important for his long-term image and for, you know, the long-term image of the Democratic Party to not look like someone who's just, you know, sort of going to get his way and is going to, you know, either take his ball and go home or if he doesn't get his way. I think it's extremely important for him to continue to talk. And I think it just, in terms of the pure politics of it, I think it portrays a really good image that a lot of Americans will find appealing.
And, you know, Republicans are happy now. I mean, I watched a few hours of this debate. They have found their voice. And their voice is, you know, the national debt went up 86% under Bush. Mm. They didn't like that at all. They didn't like to have to carry so much spending water for Bush. And again, you heard them saying, we got to get back to fundamentals. We have to, you know, be the party of at least a fiscal prudence. We can't be spending. And they were almost joyful. And I didn't sense it was so much anti-Obama as we have discovered what we are. We are conservatives.
And this may be their only option.
Yes.
Yeah. And Joe is on the line with us from Columbia, South Carolina. Joe, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, sir. And I hope you fellows are doing fine also. But anyway, my question is about the Republicans. You know, you just mentioned about how the Republicans are being so joyful. But, you know, to me, they have to take some of the blame for us being in the condition we are today, too. I mean, they say we can't borrow and spend, but, you know, under Bush, they rubber stamped everything he wanted. Borrowing, spending, oh, tax cuts. And let's talk about the tax cuts for a minute. And they always say they want all these tax cuts. Okay, we gave them all them back in the early part of the 2000, what, you know what, the first thing Bush did, that's the first thing we gave them, right? The big giant tax cuts.
So, Joe, what you're saying is that we've tried tax cuts before. They simply don't work. We might as well try something new. Charles Babington, what do you think?
Well, going back to Jack Beatty's point, if I can take a little bit of issue with him, he's correct that the deficit spending did rise dramatically during President Bush's administration, but keep in mind that Republicans controlled the Congress for six of those 8 years. They may not have been wild about it, but they were in a position to stop it, and they didn't. And, you know, we could go on forever of the reasons for that, and obviously the war necessitated a fair amount of spending and that sort of thing. But Jack is right that the Republicans do seem happy this week that they have found their voice, at least in the House. They are taking a political gamble, though. Obama is popular now. He won by a hefty electoral college margin. The public, for now, for the most part, is behind him. And if they stand, you know, shoulder to shoulder against him, as they certainly did on this vote in the House on the stimulus, it could be a political risk. And Joe has very nicely laid out the argument that a lot of Democrats make, is that particularly the tax cuts for the upper income Americans, which were part of Bush's first term. You know, it's the Democrats campaigned on rolling those back. Now, because of the economy sinking and the need to have a stimulus, they're going to have to hold off on that. But the Democrats have been itching for some time to roll those tax cuts back.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I just wanted to add in also, it's always a lot easier to be anti-spending when you're an opposition party. When you control, as Republicans did for a period of time, both chambers of Congress and the presidency, people expect you to do something. They don't just expect you to say, I'm going to do less. But when you're in the opposition, it's a lot easier to say, you know, we should be spending less.
And perhaps this is their best course of action.
It could be, you know, but I tend to agree that I think it's a risk to portray yourself as I think it was Representative Cantor who said earlier this week, simply as the party of no.
Mm-hmm. And there may be fewer no's in the Senate. 9 Republican senators are from states that President Obama carried. So you can expect at least some of them are going to be for this package.
This is On Point. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. ice and snow shut down parts of the country this week, and President Obama took that opportunity to rib the District of Columbia government for declaring a snow emergency. They'd never do that in Chicago, he said.
My children's school was canceled today because of what?
Ice.
Some ice.
Meanwhile, the president will join millions of Americans this weekend to watch the Cardinals and Steelers battle it out in Super Bowl 43. Pittsburgh is heavily favored to beat Arizona. It's a prediction that sits perfectly well with Cardinals head coach Ken Wisenhunt.
We have been the underdog in every one of our playoff games, and it's served us well, so I don't have any problem with that.
And a California woman, mother to six children already, welcomed octuplets this week. Here's her obstetrician, Dr. Karen Maples.
We delivered eight babies yesterday morning, six boys, two girls, with an amazing team of professionals.
My guests today are Ta-Nehisi Coates of the Atlantic Monthly, Charles Babington from the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Gentlemen, I want to play briefly a clip from this past week. It is former Illinois governor, Rod Blagojevich, who stood on the floor of the Illinois State House to defend himself earlier this week.
You haven't proved a crime, and you can't because it hadn't happened. You haven't given me a chance to disprove a crime, but so far a crime has not been proven here in this impeachment proceeding. How can you throw a governor out of office with insufficient and incomplete evidence?
Jack Beatty, Governor Blagojevich also made the rounds on the television networks this week. Charles Babington, I believe he also did an interview with the Associated Press. He's now been thrown out. He's been impeached. What was he thinking? What was he trying to do by going on network television?
Well, I saw some of those interviews, and I watched as much as I could bear of his stream of consciousness. And I was reminded of the line of Yeats, the best lack all conviction, the worst are full of a passionate intensity, because he had such eloquence as he defended himself. But I think Chris Matthews made the shrewdest comment on this, that he's been, in his comments, he's been signaling out ethnic groups and interest groups in the city of Chicago for whom he has done favors as a governor. I did this for this group. I did that for the other group. I've been a crusader for the elderly. And Matthews suggested what he's really doing is working the Chicago jury pool. You know, he's looking ahead to make sure those jurors out there know all the good things he did for them.
Because, of course, he still faces federal charges.
He does. He does, yeah.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, of course, President Obama was a member of that chamber that decided to oust their governor last night. Has the Obama administration managed to sort of sail past this unscathed, or do you suspect that when these federal charges are thrown at former Governor Blagojevich, some members of the administration may become involved with this?
Oh, it'll come up again when the trial, I think, happens. But so far, yeah, and it's not through any favors from Blagojevich, who wanted to bring in Rahm Emanuel into the chambers, wanted to bring in Valerie Jarrett. I mean, he saw that as his way out. If he was going down, he was going to drag as many as he could with him. But so far, it really hasn't stuck to Obama. And again, I think part of that goes back to a debate amongst Republicans as to how much to try to tar him with Blagojevich. And we saw a lot of that in the early days. And then people just decided it was a bad idea and they backed off.
And of course, we heard this week that he had planned to approach Oprah Winfrey for that Senate seat that eventually went to Roland Burris. Do you think that's simply a gimmick, or do you think that
was that serious? Was that? I think at that point he was just. He's very eloquent. He is very eloquent, but the Oprah Winfrey thing, I think, had a lot to do with him going on Oprah's show that week. I think that was what that was about.
Yeah, Charles Babington, have we seen the last of Rod Blagojevich?
I think we have until the federal trial comes up. You made a good point about Obama. What struck me early on when these wiretaps first came out
was how little Obama and his people had to do or tried to do with having almost anything to say about who succeeded him in the Senate, which, after all, is an important position. Can you imagine somebody like Lyndon Johnson, just, you know, having, not caring what the Texans did about filling a Senate seat from Texas? It'd be unthinkable. There's a lot of politicians who, as they move up the ranks, they want to have as much influence over their entire state as possible. And Obama just did not really seem to care very much, or was certainly willing to let it play out. And he seemed to be looking forward and not back. And, of course, in retrospect, that's a very fortunate thing for him, because he, you know, his people would have been caught on the wiretaps if they had been trying to influence that that filling of the job.
Julia is on the line from Rochester, Vermont. Julia, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to share some comments on Blagojevich, as I see him. I read the criminal complaint online soon after it was made available. And one thing that isn't being repeated much in the press is that one of the things that he tried to do, which he was being investigated for, was he tried to get a newsman fired from the Chicago Tribune for opposing, or for trying to expose, Blagojevich's corruption and calling for impeachment. And he also tried to punish the Tribune by pulling strings to withhold state funding from their plans to improve Wrigley Field.
Which, of course, Julia, was, and I believe, and you may know this better than I believe that was cited on the floor of the Illinois State House legislature, rather, during these proceedings over the past 4 days, that this was brought up, that he had tried to do these things.
I'm sure it was. But you know, it's not making it into the various little thumbnail accounts online and in the newspapers. But my reading of Blagojevich is, I think he, my reading of him from the tapes, was that he was panicking, that he can't seem to function on his own in terms of finding work. You know, he's a real creature of this patronage system that's been going on. But he's and that explains why he's grabbing at everything, like, you know, somebody sinking and trying to bring everybody down with him.
Almost like a cartoon character, in a sense, kind of a self-parody. Jack Beatty, Rod Blagojevich, not somebody easy to take seriously anymore.
Oh, no. I mean, he really he's now deeply into self-caricature. And you know, that sound we just heard, splash, to use Junior's metaphor, was Mr. Blagojevich falling under the waves of public attention, I think.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call, Julia. A lot of news this week, of course, on the Middle East front. President Obama gave his first televised interview to Al Arabiya, an Arab language news network. He spoke about fostering better relations between Islam and the West.
My job is to communicate to the American people that the Muslim world is filled with extraordinary people who simply want to live their lives and see their children live better lives.
Charles Babington, how serious is this administration's commitment to trying to jumpstart the Middle East peace process?
Well, first of all, Guy, I think symbolically that was a very important note that Obama did give his first interview after becoming president to Al-Arabiya. It's, believe me, the Associated Press and New York Times and Washington Post and many others have been clamoring for some time, you know, let us be first. And I just thought symbolically that was very important. The economy is taking up so much oxygen right now in Washington and in the country that I think every sign indicates that the president very much wants to be heavily involved in the Middle East, to try to improve that situation there. He's named special envoys on top of Hillary Rodham Clinton going to the State Department. I think his first trip is going to be to Canada, his first foreign trip, but at some point he's almost certain to go at least to a Muslim world perhaps country and perhaps to an Arab country. That's going to be a phenomenal trip, I think, in terms of people's reception or reaction to it. But I think for now, I think the economy is going to take front and center in United States politics. And we'll have to see how this plays out. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he appointed and Secretary of State Clinton appointed George Mitchell, former U.S. Senator George Mitchell, as the Mideast envoy. Senator Mitchell didn't waste any time, went to the region, spoke to reporters in Jerusalem this week, and said he and Israeli Prime Minister Olmert had discussed a number of key issues in their talks.
As the Prime Minister and I discussed, of critical importance is consolidating the ceasefire, including a cessation of hostilities, an end to smuggling, and the reopening of the crossings based on the 2005 agreement.
Jack Beatty, in the wake of the Gaza war from December to January of this year, it doesn't seem like there is much of an opening to jumpstart this process. Is George Mitchell somebody who might just be able to pull it off?
Well, he's a man of epic patience. He said that in Ireland he failed for 450 days or something like that and succeeded on one. Now, I'm afraid it's going to take more than 451 days here, but he's the person to do it, and he has credentials for being even-handed on this issue, which really matters. A big stumbling block coming up, though, is this Israeli election, or it's likely to be. Foreign Minister Livni, who's a candidate in the election, says that if Benjamin Netanyahu wins, quote, the clash with the U.S. is inevitable. Mm. And one of the clashes is going to be over settlement activity. Settlement, according to the Jerusalem Post, went up 69% expansion in just last year. And Netanyahu says he doesn't want new settlements, but he wants to increase the size of the existing ones. That is directly in the face of what of what Obama needs if he wants to get a settlement. So I see there could be some real conflict there.
And Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, the head of the Likud party, the right-wing party, a former prime minister himself, who at times clashed with President Clinton. But could a Netanyahu victory, how could that affect the relationship with an Obama administration?
Well, I mean, it'll just be if he keeps to this idea of, you know, expanding settlements, that will create problems right there, unless they can work out some sort of swap out with territories now in Israel to the new Palestinian state, if we ever get there. Mm-hmm. So from the U.S. point of view, it isn't desirable. On the other hand, it was under Prime Minister Begin, who was the most furthest, a right wing Israeli, I think, at the time, that Israel made the agreement with Egypt. So sometimes you get the Nixon to China phenomenon.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, President Obama's interview to Al Arabiya, his statements about changing the image of Americans and America in the Arab and Islamic world. How far do you think that will go in starting to reverse some of the bad blood that certainly was exacerbated over the past 8 years?
I think a lot farther than most people think. We get caught up in substance, and there was a lot of talk during the election about how Obama was all substance and not style. And substance in policy is obviously extremely, extremely important. Please don't take this the wrong way. But I think people underestimate how much basic statements of respect do for your image. I think, and we saw that, in terms of bring them on, get them dead or alive. I think basic statements of respect say so much. And in terms of repairing America's image in the Islamic world and in the broader world at large, I'm not saying that that interview is going to solve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I'm not sure what's going to happen there. But in terms of repairing image, I think just a baseline, a basic sort of respect, a sense of, yes, I hear you, I think we'll just go a long way.
Mm-hmm. And Ta-Nehisi, you've written quite a bit about the first family, Michelle Obama, and have actually interviewed her as well. You've written about how this family has already started to shift attitudes on race in this country.
Yeah, and you know, there are two ways of looking at it. Some people look at them as a particularly exceptional family, and there's certainly some truth to that. I don't think there are many families where you have two people. Both people went to Ivy League schools, obviously with very successful lawyers. But I think beyond that, there was a great point that Michelle Obama's mother made to me when I interviewed her, and that is that she was very annoyed by the fact that they're talked about as particularly exceptional African Americans. And she said, we have this throughout our black communities, throughout our country. And I think that's so true. I think the image of African Americans is people who, just like other Americans, want to compete, want to go out and feed their families, work a good job, have the same dream as all other Americans, as opposed to just thinking about African Americans as the black poor and that being the end of the conversation. I think that's going to be a tremendous change in how race is seen in this country.
Mm-hmm. And finally this week, of course, we lost one of the great post-war American writers, John Updike. Jack Beattie, where does he fit in among his peers?
Well, he's a giant, and American civilization, I think, is the poorer. Yesterday, the New York Times published a poem of his from a now posthumous collection to be soon to be published. It's called, fittingly enough, Requiem. And here's John Updike. It came to me the other day, were I to die, no one would say, oh, what a shame, so young, so full of promise, depths unplumbable. Instead, a shrug and tearless eyes will greet my overdue demise. The wide response will be, I know, I thought he died a while ago. For life's a shabby subterfuge, and death is real and dark and huge. The shock of it will register nowhere but where it will occur. In fact, the shock registers everywhere to everyone who uses the English language. They are in his debt.
Jack Beattie.
He got a lot more than that.
Yeah, Jack Beattie reading Requiem. Charles Babington from the AP, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ta-Nehisi Coates from Atlantic, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, Jack Beattie, our news analyst, thanks for being with us.
A pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Our show is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Huang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Kathy Corman, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.